This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 65 for the week of June 15th, 2009. Solid. Developer, we feature an interview with Derek Whitaker. Derek talks with us about the SOLID principles and other good coding practices. Let's listen to the interview. Hey, I'm here with my friend Derek Whitaker. Derek, can you say hi to everybody?
Hi.
Derek, what do you do?
Right now, I'm a software engineer with a healthcare company out of Raleigh, North Carolina, and just write code, have fun.
Yeah, and on the side, you do a couple of community things, right?
I do. You know, speaking is one of the things I'm really enjoying. You know, helping organize code camps is one.
And then, the Chicago Code Camp was about a week and a half ago.
Yes, and hopefully we'll do another one in the future.
I heard there's one in the works for the fall.
We are talking about one for the fall.
And certainly we'll mention it on the show when it starts coming around. But, you know, you're a big community guy. You're also a Microsoft MVP.
I am.
Which specialty?
C-Sharp.
C-Sharp. Cool.
I'm also an ASP insider, and I got that mostly from the other project that I do, which is Dimecast.net.
So tell us about Dimecast real quick.
Well, Dimecast is a website for hosting where I host 10-minute episodes on .NET-related content. You know, and I started it, it's about a year now. I think we just released 115th episode today.
115 in a year.
115, yeah.
Okay, I'm officially embarrassed because we're a year and a half in the Thirsty Developer, and we're in the 60s.
Well, mine are 10 minutes. And I've got other people sending them to me. You know, of the 115, I think I've done 75-ish.
So a lot of distributed processing there, right?
Yes, yes. You know, and it's really great is occasionally I'll get an email from somebody that says, hey, I have these. Do you want them? Well, if the content is good and it's good quality.
If they're in the can, especially. That's our lingo for, hey, Dave, I've got a show recorded this week.
Yes. You know, if all I got to do is edit it and render it, it saves me a solid 2 hours of effort.
And we've actually mentioned the Dimecast on the show before. I don't know if you know that. Right after you launched, I think
that you were
probably five or six episodes into it. And we pointed everybody there. I love the concept. I love the name, right? And I love the concept that it's 10 minutes. And I've actually pulled up some of the Dimecast when wanting to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the impetus of it, right? It's not like you're going to get a theoretical and go on and on.
It really kind of started because I was watching a lot of other ones that had great content. You know, 30, 60 minute worth of content. But my ADD kicks in around, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it. And I started thinking, really, what am I doing here? I'm looking for 10 minutes worth of the content in this video. So you hunt and you peck and you find what you want. And then I was going to do it just as a blog series.
And oh, really?
Yeah. It was just going to be like a blog series to start off on like unit testing, you know, and using mocking frameworks. And a couple friends are like, no, that's a really cool idea if you can turn it into a platform. And I did. And I went gung-ho at first. And was releasing 3 and 4 a week.
Yeah.
And I realized it's probably better to pace myself.
Right.
Because the first 20 or 30 are easy. It's after that it gets a little more complicated to come up with content.
We've talked about that. Dave and I have talked about that with this show. That we really thought that, you know, after like 10, 15 episodes, we'd be pretty much done. There's always more content to do, but keeping that quality bar up is tough doing that.
And finding the time.
The time, yeah.
In your case, finding the other people to work with you. You know, finding their time.
Well, Dave and I are going to start interviewing ourselves more.
Oh, sweet.
We actually did. Episode 61 was me interviewing Dave about something that he was working on.
Oh, so it'd be better if you interviewed yourself.
Well, yeah, that would be kind of weird, you know?
Two different voices.
You know what? I'm going to try that. We'll see if that works.
You know, you can almost pretend you have, like, the mannequin.
And the nice thing about that is unlike our normal shows, I would have to know the questions ahead of time.
Oh, that might be a challenge.
You didn't do what a lot of people do to us. And because I ask a lot of people, hey, you want to be on the show?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that I get periodically, about one in every five, is like, you know, hey, I'd love to be on the show. Send me the questions that you're going to ask me. And I say, like, hey, you've never listened to the show, obviously, because this is not a scripted drama.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, our formula, and you've clearly fallen into this, is our formula has always been find a really smart person. Which, you're a smart person.
That's debatable.
find an interesting topic, right, and ask really good questions. And as Dave and I say, that's generally when it falls apart. The asking really good questions is our job. But, you know, finding the smart people and the interesting topics are, you know, easy to do.
Yeah, and I like the conversation flow more than the let's read a question, get an answer. Read a question, get an answer. Because it's boring that way.
And you know what? Nobody is, when we said, like, you know, hey, if you listen to the show, it's, you know, just, it's questions that come up. And that's what's one of the challenges is, like, having the questions, particularly if you're not, like, well-versed in the topic. Nobody has listened to the show and then come back and said, no, I'm not going to do it. I really need the questions ahead of time. It's interesting that some people will actually print out notes for themselves about what they want to talk about. And they never get used, which is a sign that we're doing some of the right things. So a couple more questions for you, just to get to know you. And this is a new meme that we're going to start. You know, first of all, what are you drinking?
This is a caramel, or no, what is this? It's a caramel macchiato, upside down.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the Thirsty Developer, so we're gonna you know, start asking people, like, you know, what are you drinking? So,
I should have brought beer.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we're going to shoot for. But so what was your first programming language?
Quick Basic. Back in high school, I was a late bloomer compared to a lot of the tech guys. I didn't pick up my first PC until senior in high school, but it was Quick Basic.
Okay.
There was a PC in one of the classrooms that just had a command line, and me and a couple other people just started playing, and it was like draw little lines on the screen.
Okay.
And at that point, we were pretty much hooked.
So did you dissect Quick Basic Gorillas?
No.
That might have been a later version of Quick Basic. They actually, you know, had a sample program that shipped with it called, and we mentioned on the show before, it's a two-player game. One person on each side of it, and they throw bananas at each other.
No, that would have been interesting. That might have got me into the gaming realm, though.
Right, okay.
I never really got into the gaming thing either, and maybe that would have done it. I knew I missed my calling.
All right, so that was your first programming language. What's your favorite programming language?
I still like C#. You know, I started my first professional language, if you will, was RPG in college. I did an internship for about a year and a half. Did that. It's not bad. I'm not a big, you know, mainframe guy, but then went to VB6, which, you know, at the time was hip and cool.
Right. Many of us went through VB6, yes.
And then made the transition to VB.net for a few years and been C# now for, I don't know, 5-6 years. And I always explore the languages. The one I'm looking at now is Ruby, just to see what the hubbub is about and see if I like it. And
all the cool kids are doing Ruby.
I've got to get a Mac then too, right?
No, Ruby runs on, you know, any
all
platform.
All the cool kids have Macs and they run Ruby.
Well, but you can be a cool kid and be Ruby on Windows, so...
You know,
soon Ruby on the DLR.
You know, I've downloaded Iron Ruby. It's just finding time to play with all those toys, right?
It seems like I always struggled with that, and it's just becoming to the point where I no longer struggle with it. I just like go, oh yeah, I'm never going to learn everything. So,
well, you know, I download the IDEs, you know, like the Ruby IDE, and I've even got Java IDE because I want to add some plugins to our build server. But I'll never do it. I'll just never find the time.
So that's a nice transition to the next question, and that is, three indispensable development tools other than the IDE itself?
You need a refactoring tool.
Okay.
You know, and a lot of people have used the joke or the comment that ReSharper, you know, basically Visual Studio is the IDE for ReSharper. I'm a big ReSharper fan. I can't see coding without it.
Okay.
Reflector is a good tool.
Excellent tool, yeah.
You know, and if you're still doing database stuff, you know, you need something like Redgate's SQL prompt.
Okay.
To give you SQL refactoring. And you can see a lot of those just kind of revolve around the refactoring concept and the modifying code concept.
If you weren't doing code or technology, what would you be doing?
I've always joked that if I could make the same money doing golf course maintenance, I would.
You know, landscaping is my answer too. So
I did golf course maintenance for a couple summers in college, and there is absolutely nothing more gratifying than driving that mower down the fairway and looking back and seeing what we just did.
Yeah.
You know, that's something we don't really get in the software world. Right. So only 3 to 6 months down the road, it's like, oh, yeah, now we're done.
The thing is, though, that there's a lot of rework in land maintenance, too.
Well, you got to do it over again pretty much every 3 days.
Yeah.
But the upside is, if you screw it up, it's going to be back normal in about 3 days anyways.
Yeah. And final question, non-development related, what program couldn't you live without? Software.
What software program could I not live without? You know, I don't really know. Besides writing code, I don't use my PC much. I hate to say that.
That's not a bad answer, yeah.
We download and we take a ton of photos of our kids, but it's pretty much raw, you know, downloaded and thrown to disk, and my wife throws them up on, you know, Shutterfly, and they're done. So maybe Photoshop. My wife definitely wouldn't let me live without Photoshop, because then I couldn't resize all our images.
Red eye correction, cropping, all that. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good answer. So you're going to present to the .NET user group here locally in a little less than an hour here.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, we got to watch the time, you know, because we actually do have a hard deadline. And you're going to talk about the solid principle.
I am.
And there's been a lot about the solid principle the last few months. If you're a technology person, you listen to podcasts, you've probably stumbled on solid on a couple of different shows.
Oh, yeah. You know, Uncle Bob, Robert Martin in particular, has been on, what, two or three or four different ones in the last year alone.
Right.
You know?
And I actually got pointed to Bob Martin's talk on Hansel Minutes because I was listening to Stack Overflow, which is Spolsky and Atwood's podcast. Mm-hmm. And not only do I do podcasts, that's pretty much all I listen to.
Which time on Hansel Minutes? He's on twice now.
Well, I haven't got to the second one.
Yeah, me neither. I listened to one at Ordev.
Oh, okay. I heard the very first one that was like probably December or January of this year.
This sounds right.
Okay. And then I heard about it because Joel Spolsky went on a little bit of a rant about it. I went and listened to the Bob Martin, Scott Hanselman interview. And then, ironically enough, the next show that downloaded on Stack Overflow was Bob Martin and, you know, being a guest.
Listen to that one.
It's great because the first thing that Spolsky does is apologize. He's like, you know, the attack was a little bit of an ad hominem attack. There is a little bit of an academic feel to Solid sometimes.
There is, you know, and in, like anything that would be considered a best practice, you know, and some of these design principles, and not just Solid, there's other ones out there too. You know, some people see these as if you don't do it this way, you can't write successful code.
Right.
And I would like to say I agree with that 100%, but the reality is you can write really crappy spaghetti code and have it be a successful application.
Right.
But your odds are lower. Your chances are much lower. You know, and if you subscribe to these principles, ideally you'll help yourself in the long run. You know, so hopefully it will, you know, hopefully it does become the best practice. If you don't follow, 10 years from now, you won't be successful.
In a lot of ways, and I'm a believer of the Solid principle because a single responsibility is something that I've always preached, and we'll probably talk about this as we go along. And in a minute or two, we have to define what that is for the listeners who aren't aware of what Solid is.
But you know what actually started off as S-O-L-D-I.
Yeah.
His original article. And then someone convinced or mentioned to him that if you swap those letters, it becomes
a cooler acronym. Yeah. It reminds me of when you were learning about writing in high school. And I had this great senior writing teacher that really just drilled these things into us. And she really changed my life. She made me a much better writer. And I thank her for that. You would be pounded on when you were writing about following proper grammar. And then you'd read, a good example would be Tom Sawyer. It's like, well, there's the word ain't all over this thing, lady. And she'd say, you know what? Once you know the rules, you're allowed to break them. And I think that's, the Solid principles, you know, if you understand why you're doing it, and there are times that exceptions always apply or shortcuts always apply because you got to get things done. Understanding that you're breaking the rule is important. That allows you to break the rule better or less bad.
Yes, because then you at least understand the intent of, in this case, the principles.
Right.
Right. You know, some people look at, you know, like take a new language or new pattern, new practice or new principle, and they just follow blindly, but they don't actually learn the intent behind it, which means they're probably going to not succeed in the long run. Because if they're going to start making judgment calls, which they don't understand the judgment calls they're making, and they're going to cut corners and they're going to be like, oh, well, this doesn't work for me. Well, it didn't work for you because you didn't understand it.
Right. So let's define Solid.
Well, Solid
or SOLD-E.
SOLD-E, yeah, I'm not going to go there. Solid's a five-letter acronym, clearly.
Yep.
I'm spelling impaired. Now, even I know that one. The first one's single responsibility, and that essentially stating that, you know, a object, at the simplest term, has one reason to exist and one reason only. Many times, and the example I'll give tonight's a method that does everything, right? Connects a database, calls web services, you know, sends emails. That's not a single responsibility.
Right.
You know, that's four or five responsibilities. And you know, those are, if you jump ahead to the D, there's too many dependencies there as well.
Right.
The next one.
And that's one thing is that a lot of the individual things are correlated with each other.
For the most part, all of them interrelate. And you can't really successfully do one without at least doing the other ones somewhat successfully.
Right.
Which does, by the way, make it pretty hard to demo. Because, like in my demo tonight, I want to talk about single responsibility first. And then, I'm not breaking out the dependencies yet.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I'll get there. The next one's the open-close principle. You know, that's the O and the Solid. And that basically states that when a class is open for extension but closed for modification. And where that really comes useful and valuable is when you need to go back later and make changes. You know, the first instinct for most developers is just start diving into the guts of the method or the object.
And then you start breaking stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You start taking the hatchet and the machete to it, and you know all of a sudden you just broke half your app. Well, that's the wrong approach. So the open-close principle helps to to mitigate that risk and helps you, you know, find a way to get around it and make it so you can modify things or extend things in this case and make the app so that you're not touching the app for the most part. You're just changing behavior and adding extensions onto it. The L is Liskov substitution principle, which is always the hardest for me to explain.
Right.
You know, because it's basically stating that a subtype must be replaceable for the base type. It's hard to give example of that. The conical one is a square is a rectangle.
Yeah.
You know, although Uncle Bob actually attempts to prove that wrong based on certain scenarios. You know, it's basically stating that if I have a base class, and you know, a square, I can create an instance of a rectangle and set it equal to my square variable, so to speak. And it takes on the behavior of the rectangle. You know, so that's the L, the Liskov substitution. I is the interface segregation principle, which is just a fancy way of saying slap an interface on things. It's the simplest way to turn it down, but really it's also talking about code by contract and coding to an interface. And a lot of people, when you start talking about this, they're like, well, why should I put an interface on an object if I'm only going to use that object in one place? Well, the reality is you might be only using it one place today, but you might be using it five places tomorrow.
You're on version one, buddy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also by providing an interface allows you to do some other things down the road. You know, testability becomes simpler when you have interfaces because now you can test the interfaces versus concretes and you can do things like mocking and use isolation frameworks. So that's the interface segregation. And then the last one is the dependency inversion, which really people think of as inversion of control, but it's really the dependency inversion. And that's basically stating that you shouldn't know about your dependencies when in your code. So an example is you shouldn't know directly how to read to a file system.
Okay. Because
that's a dependency you can't control, right? So wrap a layer of indirection around that. You know, wrap it in a file system manager, if you will, and provide that to the object. But you don't actually want to create an instance of that file system manager inside your object. You want it to be provided to you via either constructor injection, setter injection, or even parameter injection if you really wanted to. So that way you can change those out in the future, or you can just have it, you know, a new implementation and the method is none the wiser because going back to the single responsibility, it's not its responsibility to know how to write to the file system. So in a nutshell, those are the five acronyms. And, you know, those are the ones that are getting all the play today. But in reality, there's, you know, I think 8 or 10, maybe 11, that if you go out to objectmentor.com that he lists out, Uncle Bob that is, on his website. And they're all just principles. You know, they're on like a pattern where a pattern's meant to solve a problem. Principles are just guidance.
Right.
You know, follow these and you might be better off than if you didn't follow them. It's about the basic, you know, the basis of what a principle is, in my opinion.
Now, I will say one of the things that when we start having debates about this is that one of the things I like to point out to people, it's like, hey, there's nothing new about these. I mean,
These are
principles that have been around a while. And it's funny that you mention, you know, that interfaces is such a, you know, forefront in this because you're an old VB6 programmer. Did you read Ted Pattison's book back in the day?
I may have.
So he actually talked about development with VB6, and I forget the title of the book. It was pretty much everybody who was not a form one button one programmer mm-hmm. said this is how you ought to be doing code in VB, and you didn't have in classic VB.
They didn't show me that in school because it was form one button one in school.
Yeah, I talk that a lot when we talk about client server and why it was so bad. Client server as an architecture wasn't necessarily bad. The problem was we put all the business logic behind form one button one.
We still do, sadly.
Yeah. We've gotten a little better about that. I would hope. No, we haven't. There's nothing that prevents you from doing it, right? So
until you can lock it down, that says this button can't do anything. No logic. You know, the MVC frameworks are attempting to solve that problem, by using the MVC pattern.
Right.
But nothing stops you from using the controllers in that example.
So in Pattison's book, and this is like, you know, over 10 years ago in the classic VB6 COM era, you know, he actually said that what you should do is how you should write your VB is you create a DLL with a bunch of interfaces in it and you never touch it again. Right?
That's a maintenance nightmare.
Then you create another DLL that has your classes that implement those interfaces. And that's where your implementation should be. And there's a lot of those, you know, a lot of the solid principles just in that style of coding.
Yeah, there are. And if you look past software development, a lot of these principles and patterns that we're following now that are all the rage, at least in the .NET community, the Java community seemed to have gotten some of this a few years ahead of us. They're a little bit older community.
Right.
But think about your car. I'm not a mechanic, so I'm probably speaking halfway wrong here. But all the individual components of your car know nothing about the other individual components of the car. You know, the starter doesn't understand what connects to it. It just knows that it does something and the engine starts.
Yeah.
You know, why is that so hard for, we are software engineers, per se. Why is that so hard for us when the mechanical and the automotive engineers have gotten it for, you know, decades?
That's actually a really good analogy, because the transmission in a hybrid vehicle car is not indifferent from one that's in a regular carbon-based fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
These principles apply in a lot of different places. It's just, I think software developers, at least some of the older software developers in particular, I've always done it this way. My app I wrote 20 years ago, the way I wrote it 20 years ago, worked then. Well, it may have worked, but were you able to maintain it and extend it as easily?
You know, a lot of the good programmers that I worked with on the mainframe, you know, as Dave Boss says back in the day,
yeah,
right? A lot of them got this single responsibility principle. They didn't call it that. But if you looked at the CICS transactions that they made, you know, now they would have like 700 or 800 of them in a system, right? But every one of those transactions did one thing.
Yeah, and they just chained them all together.
And that's the thing, is that you could actually press a button, you know, on your terminal, and it could fire off one of 700 programs, depending on what was on what was actually, you know, presented on the screen itself.
And they had the, you know, the segregation and the interfaces, because here are the five ways you can call this class or this program in those cases.
The only thing that made that brittle was the fact that it was procedure. You know, every one of those transactions was procedural, right?
Well, that and. You know, I was at a place that was a mainframe app, and this was 2+ years ago, so not that long ago, that had tens of thousands of little apps that ran around that nobody knew what was there. So chances are they had 10 of the same app, because they made them so small and they just never kept an inventory of them.
The maintenance on those systems, because they had grown up over years, you know, you could literally say, okay, this is the line of code I want to change. That line of code could be duplicated in 10 different libraries.
Yeah, the copy and paste refactoring.
Object-oriented copy and paste.
Object-oriented copy and paste.
I was going to make a system to do that, you know. The other thing I've been working on, Derek, maybe you can help me with this, is my PowerPoint compiler, where you take the marketing's PowerPoint and you put it into a compiler and the system comes out the other end.
No.
No?
No, I can't help there. I'm sorry.
You can't take those glowing things and, you know, because I've actually been handed I got handed a spec once that was 3 lines on a PowerPoint slide. I was like, you want me to make an entire administration system off of 3 bullet points on the last slide in the deck?
Yeah. They want to look exactly like that, and that was your requirements.
Well, no, this was all text.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this was literally like 3 bullet points. This is what the administration system should do.
Wow, I haven't had that. I've had people give me access forms, say, here's my app,
duplicate
it.
I would rather do the PowerPoint compiler than here's the form, yeah. Make this.
Back slightly after .NET came out, I looked into doing a side gig where this woman, she was billing for a medical company, and the entire client server application was an Access app.
Yep.
And I spent about a week looking into it. I said, yeah, thanks, but I'm out of here.
I want to spend a minute diving in the single responsibility, because I think that this is the one that I think the other ones that most people kind of grasp, but I have a hard time wrapping myself around this, because the employee class is kind of the bane of the example, right? Because you'd think that, hey, I use employee everywhere, or you could use customer, you could use order, right? Mm-hmm. But any one of those canonical things get touched a lot, right?
They do.
When you take a pure object-oriented approach, you could say that, hey, the employee has these properties, you know, it has these methods and all that. How would you deconstruct the typical book example of the employee class into single responsibility?
In our, we're going to use the employee here, and let's say the employee's got to clock in and clock out of a system.
Yep.
Is it the employee's job to clock in and clock out, or is there some kind of clock in, clock out mechanism, a time clock, if you will, that maybe you just provide the employee object to the time clock, and it just does something behind the scenes? Well, the employee's job isn't, you know, the employee object's job isn't to know how the time clock system works or care how it works or anything like that, or even know what it does behind the scenes. You know, so for me, it's just simply, what is it that the employee is meant to do? You know, if we're talking about just like an object, a property bag, it knows its first name, last name, social security number, you know, ID. If it's supposed to do other things, you know, connect to the database, I shouldn't do that. You know, that's not its responsibility at all.
Let's go back to the set of properties, because this is something I'm going to tell a little bit of a story. We, you know, and this is like when .NET was first new, we were looking at kind of what should our objects look like. And we coined the terms, and I'm sure that they existed previously. It's not like we actually invented these, but, you know, should our objects be more, you know, property oriented or method oriented? At the time, you saw a lot of, hey, set these 10 properties and call this method.
Yes.
And there was no parameters in that method. It grabbed what was in the property, and that made for a very stateful object, which did some interesting things to performance and scalability.
Calling the method had to be knowledgeable.
Had to be very knowledgeable.
Each individual state piece they had to set correctly.
And there would be some dependencies between those, right? Because the implementation of any one of those could affect the other.
So your properties aren't just properties. They actually did things behind the scenes.
Potentially, right? You as the caller would only see the public part of that, right? Now, the other approach was more of a what we called method normal form, which was, you know, hey, let's not have a lot of properties that are going to have a lot of state to them. Let's, you know, have methods with parameters in it. And we were VB programmers, so the optional parameter, we absolutely loved that, right?
Oh, yes.
Because that got you out of a lot of code. There was a guy named Bill that we worked with, and I'm not going to use his last name in case he listens to the show. But Bill said that, you know, hey, you guys are spending all this time talking about either this property normal form or this method normal form, and I got the answer for you. And he came up with what we call Bill normal form. And this was a joke, right? We never told Bill that we actually created a Bill normal form. But his idea was that every object should have one method with one parameter, and you passed XML to it. And that method parsed the XML and figured out what you needed to do.
He invented web services? No.
No, web services actually existed at the time. And that's why he said, well, web services are so simple because you take the XML document and you just pass it to this object, you know, and it figures out everything.
Until somebody doesn't understand how to build that XML document.
Or somebody needs to change that. I mean, you got into real exponential problems because literally, you know, he said that the document itself should drive what the object did. And I'm like, wow, so you're, you know, it was more like back to the EDI days.
Okay.
Right, where you would receive an EDI document and you would start parsing and say, oh, it's this transaction type, let me do this. Oh, it's got this parameter in it. You know, it made for it, clearly not a single responsibility. I mean, that's like the extreme opposite of single responsibility.
And then what happens is people say, well, I don't want to modify the document schema. I'll start using last name for company name if there's no first name.
Or overloading specific values. So it wasn't just a matter of, you know, having an element that said what shipping was. You had to have logic in there that said, oh, if it's from this person, these are the shipping codes that they use.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was on a system that if you provided 666 items on an order line, that didn't mean you wanted 666 items. It actually, I think, meant canceled the order item for the previous order.
I love those codes.
Oh, yeah. It was 666, 777, 888, 999. And we didn't find out until after we went to production.
Yeah, I remember there was an issue with a lot of systems on September 9th, 1999, because people had actually coded like the date value of 9999.
Okay.
You know, as with special logic to do, like that was the null date or something like that, or the max date.
Because we'll never be on that day.
No, that's years away. That passed already.
And that's somebody else's problem.
Well, yeah, we could lament too much. From a pragmatic standpoint, how does the, you know, if you're an enterprise developer, how do you look at tackling single responsibility?
Well, go back to your question a few minutes ago about the properties and the methods. My initial design for most objects is everything's read-only. So if my method or my object has to have properties on it, everything's read-only.
Okay.
Only until you tell me of a justifiable reason are you allowed to set me.
Okay.
You know, and I tend to follow you're not allowed to construct an object without telling me all the valid state it needs, whether it be all of its dependencies in a lot of cases, or you can't construct a employee without employee ID, as an example.
So you're a big fan of the constructor. Do you use multiple constructors?
Not normally. If I can get away with it, no.
Okay.
I also tend to use an IOC container, which pretty much goes for the greediest constructor anyways.
An IOC
inversion of control.
Okay.
It's a smart factory that allows you to simplify dependency inversion principle.
Okay.
So I tend to follow the read-only properties until I need to, so don't allow people to set them. And if a method needs 5 pieces of data to be valid, then you provide me those 5 pieces of data when calling the method. Because then the caller explicitly knows, I need to provide you first name, last name, date of birth. And if I don't provide those pieces of data, something's going to go wrong.
Okay. Now, when something goes wrong, do you actually throw errors, or do you just not allow the object to be created?
In many scenarios, and in fact, one of the things I'm playing with recently is the code contracts library that's coming out of the research and development team out of Microsoft, which is a really cool little framework which allows you to do like fail checking and program by contract.
And we'll find a link for the show notes.
Oh, yeah. I've got some Dimecast on it coming out.
And we'll put a link to that, those in there.
And some blog posts.
We'll put a link to those in there.
Yeah. But yeah, I will in many scenarios. I won't do it all over the place. If it's a high-level method, say it's an API method that I expect people external to me to call, then I'll do some checking on it, some validation checking and possibly throw exceptions. If it's an internal method that I tend to use that's, hidden away by all the external callers, I do less checking on those because then I assume that if I'm calling it, I know what I'm doing.
Right, and you would protect it either by
elsewhere,
making it a private class or something like that.
Yeah, if you have to pass an employee ID at a top-level method and I pass that around three or four places, I'm probably not going to check that it's valid in three or four places.
In the lower-level ones.
Yeah, it's just kind of too expensive, in my opinion.
And I want to ask, because you're somebody who thinks about coding a lot. Exceptions or are return values?
I'm more of an exceptions guy.
Okay.
I'm more in many cases, it's a customized business exception, that gets caught maybe at the top level and wrapped and rethrown so the client can do something special to it. Because I do want to differentiate between, oh, crap, it went wrong, and we did some checking or we did some, you provided a person, an employee ID that's not in the system, that's invalid.
Right.
So I want to differentiate between, oh, craps, and we're telling you it's wrong.
So if you catch the oh, crap error, like something went wrong at the network level.
Catch and swallow. Don't show anybody. That's obviously that's a joke.
See, somebody who stopped listening to the podcast at that point, they might take you seriously.
They might. They might. I was on a project once that...
So you will bubble up those native exceptions.
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm a big believer that it would be logged first off, so that there's a log somewhere that exception was
And
caught.
Your favorite logging framework is?
Log4Net.
Still?
Still.
Cool.
At work, we use Log4Net and Enterprise Library logging blocks, along with a couple places we have custom logging. So on my plate is to condense that into one. Log4Net just seems to be the simplest and the easiest and the fastest. And
yeah, both the Enterprise Library and Log4Net, you make heavy use of configuration, which is really nice because you can say, normally I'm going to log over here, at the crud level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I need to turn it up because we're troubleshooting a problem.
Oh, yeah.
So I want more verbose logging. So
yeah, I found that out the hard way, but the painful way in Hibernate a few months back. I couldn't figure out the issue, so I turned on its fire hose.
Yeah.
In about 8 seconds, you get about 10 meg worth of logs.
Nice.
The problem was in there. It just took me a long time to figure out the problem.
It's nice, though.
But all I had to do was tweak my config file.
Fantastic
didn't change
stuff.
The app, didn't do anything.
So definitely you're a believer in interfaces?
I am.
Okay, and do you separate those out? Like I mentioned, the Ted Pattison book always talked about putting them in a separate library. And
it depends. In a lot of scenarios, not really. If I'm doing something like at work, we have a true separated client-server application, so we have a remoting interface. So in that scenario, we do have a facade interface that's shared between the client and the server.
Because that has to be physically distributed.
Exactly.
So if there's some physical distribution required, then you would do that.
Yeah. In many cases, if it's not the physical boundary of, say, remoting or even maybe web services, probably wouldn't do it.
And the other big distribution would be like a WCF. They did a contract for that, but they can get that as a reference through WSDL or whatever. So trying to think of other situations where you physically distribute that.
We've done it on other systems in the past where that's just been our programming style. Recently, not so much, where I'll physically create a separate assembly for that.
And I'll have to check. I think that the software factory done by the Patterns and Practices, I think it separated them physically, but I've
not used that in a long time.
Yeah.
Any of the CAB stuff or the
Yeah, this is the software factory, which was a separate team from the CAB.
Okay, yeah, I don't think I've ever used that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We're on a tangent, but that's okay. The reason that I liked it is when I first started looking at WCF, it was a great way of discovering attributes that were good.
Oh, okay.
Because what it would do is it would actually had a nice user interface, and you would describe your data contract, and behind the scenes in the code, it was putting attributes that were best practice that you probably wouldn't have stumbled on yourself until you ran into it to an issue.
Yeah, I've only used WCF in a few scenarios, so I definitely wouldn't have used it in that scenario.
Well, we're going to have Scott Seeley on the show in a couple weeks.
Oh, great.
Talk about WCF.
Yeah, he just put out a book a month or two ago.
Yeah, we'll be talking to him about that. So I want to be cognizant of your time because I know you're going to be speaking here in a little bit. If you could wrap up, and I think we barely scratched the surface, and you're definitely going to come back on the show.
I'd love to
come
back.
We can talk more about Solid. But if somebody was looking at this, what would three things or three or more things that you would say, you know, hey, these are the kind of priority things to do to start thinking about to look at, you know, applying Solid principles to what you're doing?
Well, the single responsibility is, in my opinion, the most valuable of all of them. You know, I don't want to say that if you do that one and nothing else, you'll be okay. But you'll definitely be better off.
Once you wrap your head around that one, the others come easy.
Get the idea that a class or a method should do one thing. You know, what people tend to get stuck on is that means I have more classes or more methods. Yeah, that's not a bad thing.
Right.
Right? Because then when you have to change that little method that has 8 lines of code, you'll do it with less risk than the method that has 300 lines of code.
Right.
So I would say the single responsibility, if you can get past my object only has one use and why should I put an interface on it, interface segregation, but one of my favorite one right now is dependency inversion. Getting rid of those damn dependencies, you know, because those dependencies make it extremely hard to test, make it extremely hard to refactor in the future, and they shouldn't be there. And you know, and the S and the D, you know, it's kind of interesting they bookend, and to me those kind of go together hand in hand. And I would say the S, the I, and D. Leave the O and the L. Pick that up on the way after those.
And again, a lot of those just come with the other ones.
Yeah, you're going to do one without, you know, if you're doing one well, say single responsibility, you're going to start to figure out pretty quick that dependency inversion is pretty important and you're going to need to do it. Then you're going to start going, I need interfaces on those dependencies so I can swap them out and test them easier.
So you would definitely recommend a dependency framework? You would have mentioned one or two?
An ILC. I'm a structure map user.
Okay.
I've been using structure map for 3 or 4 years now. Ninject has a great following. Nate Kohari's done a great job on that. I've played with it and I've used it a little bit, but I just know structure map. I've played with Spring a little bit and I've played with Castle Windsor a little bit. Never actually looked at Unity.
Okay.
For no other reason than I only need to know one or two of them.
Right.
Because they all essentially do the same thing. But you got to get past the configuration. You got to get past the what do I do? Just start small like anything else, right? Everything's a tool. Got to figure out how to use it. Figure out in the very simplest scenarios. And then you'll understand the power behind it.
Excellent. I think that's some great things to get started. Everybody, this is going to be rich with show notes, obviously. We'll have a lot of links in there, so check those out. And Derek, thank you for being on Thirsty Developer.
Appreciate having me on.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time.